Today's Tuesday, October 29th, and Larry is here with us to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. Welcome back, Larry.
Good to be with you, Nima.
When you look at the Israeli attack on Iran, Larry, do you think that Netanyahu is satisfied with the attack?
I think not, but I this is my view, and I've not had anyone corroborate it of note, but I think the United States brought sufficient pressure on him, as perhaps some other leaders in the region did, and I'm thinking particularly of the King of Jordan. They brought sufficient pressure on him to first assure that he only went after military targets or military-like targets. Two, persuade him that it might be a little bit difficult to do what he wanted to do, which it certainly was. And three, if it were and he wasn't all that successful, be content, come back, use his propaganda machine, say he was very successful and so forth, and let Iran pick it up from there. Meanwhile, we're talking to Iran at the same time through Qatar, and we're telling them essentially, this is what we're doing. We do not want a war. So let's everybody calm down. It seems to me like now, from what I'm hearing out of Tehran, that the Iranians more or less agree, though I'm not sure yet they've settled their differences within their leadership.
Yeah. And how did you find the way that Iranian government is behaving right now? How do you evaluate them?
I think they're very confident. They're confident because I think they saw how incredibly good the S-400 systems were. I'm told the Israelis would not even cross into Iranian airspace because they knew. I'm also told that what they had planned was not necessarily wave after wave after wave, but they had the echelons that they needed. They had the suppression of air defense echelon, then they had the bombing echelon, then they had the BDA and bombing anything that didn't get hit echelon. Then the two echelons that were supposed to act after the SEAD, the suppression of enemy air defense episode or echelon, didn't really react except to fire their missiles from a distance in the other country's airspace, in this case, Iraq or Syria. And so there wasn't a whole lot of accuracy. The accuracy that was achieved hit some targets that weren't all that valuable. All targets are valuable and all lives are valuable, but killed a few people. But basically, they didn't do a whole lot of damage. And so Iran is content, one, with the idea that Israel now understands that it cannot, largely because of what Russia has done for Iran. It cannot just attack Iran like it did, for example, Yemen and bomb the port of Hodeidah. It simply can't. It will be destroyed. And two, that apparently the United States' word to Iran that Israel. So now it's over to the United States, I think, to make good on its word to both sides, to be tough on Netanyahu and tell him no more, and to be lenient, if you will, with Iran and say, thank you very much. Now we can talk, or now we can use diplomacy and try to put an end to this entire mess. Of course, you still got the operations going on in Lebanon, but very rapidly there, Israel's being handed its flag. It's being told, you come any further, you're going to lose soldier after soldier after soldier. You're going to lose tank after tank. You're going to be destroyed. And you're not moving people back into the north because we've already warned them. If they come back, we'll kill them. And they're not going to come back. They're going to go to Tel Aviv and get on an airplane, leave Israel, which I think is probably what's going to happen.
And in terms of Lebanon, do you think that the Israeli people are informed about what's going on in Lebanon because they can put some sort of pressure on Netanyahu?
I don't, but I do think that the proximity and the word of mouth, which takes place in that area, regardless of propaganda, is sufficient to let them know not to mention the fact that if they set foot back in their homes, a rocket or two will come down on them. I don't think they're going to go home. And I think we're going to see a lot of them give up and leave. Yesterday, I was told the number of Jews who have left Israel in airplanes out of Tel Aviv alone is approaching a million. Now, whether they will come back or not is a big question, too, because they left having concluded that the safe haven, as it were, that Israel is supposed to provide Jews from all over the world is not real. It doesn't exist.
In your opinion, these people that are living in Israel are mostly from the northern part of Israel, or
some are, but I'm told they're pretty much from across the country. They see what's happening even through the propaganda. And you know, when you put 300,000, which is the figure I hear, reservists mostly into the front lines in either Gaza or Lebanon, and you leave them there for 6 months, 7 months, some of them I'm told have been there for 12 months without any relief, particularly the ones that went into Gaza initially. And then you do things like are happening in the invasion of Lebanon right now, which has made no progress hardly at all. And when they try to commit the reserves, you have to assemble your reserves at something called an assembly area, and then you disperse them to the points that you want them. Well, they came into the assembly area and were hit there. So they couldn't even get the reserves methodically deployed into the ones already committed, nor could they relieve the ones already committed and bring them back without being under fire. So they're taking casualties in their reserve component even before it gets into the battlefield, if you will. So it's really dangerous for anyone there now. And that kind of danger has a way of percolating back. And people find out about it by word of mouth. That they're being defeated roundly in Lebanon, I think, is going to get disseminated fairly quickly, no matter how the propaganda machine works. Because it's just so many soldiers getting injured at one time or killed at one time. And high-ranking ones getting killed or injured. The other thing about it is that I think they're falling apart at the top. I really do. I think there's a battle going on right now between Yoav Gallant and Netanyahu. And probably Gallant's battle is aided and abetted, not necessarily because they like him, but because they hate Netanyahu now, by the generals at the top of the ranks fighting in Gaza and fighting in Lebanon. So we're going to have a Netanyahu coup. We're going to have him forced out, or we're going to have him fire everybody, and then they might force him out. I don't know, but it could get really dicey here for him, because I think the leadership under him is falling apart, and they know they're falling apart because his strategy is not working, and he won't fall off of it.
I think Gallant can argue that I wasn't willing to send troops to the southern part of Lebanon. You forced me to do that.
Yes. Yes. And I understand that most of the generals that probably we would consider being level-headed and not quite as right-wingish as some of these other people have been saying that all along. And they don't particularly care for Gallant because he won't listen to them.
And Larry, do you think that today we've learned that Hezbollah has a new secretary general? And how do you find right now Hezbollah? Are they trying to find themselves in terms of their leaders, their commanders, the way that they're fighting right now in the southern part of Lebanon?
I don't think there's any panic there. I think they've had this ironed out, you know, almost like the way we did after 9/11, where we had to, you know, we knew exactly who was next and who was after him and who was after her and so forth. I think they've had this for 18 or 19 years, and they've war gamed it. They've planned it. They know exactly who takes over next, who takes over next. They know they'll lose people. They know that's a favorite tactic of the Israelis, is to cut the head off, and they've got innumerable heads, and they're going to fight them to the death.
The other thing that the...
Let me just say one other thing. Israel's never had an enemy like this. Not in its 75 plus years. It's never had an enemy like this. It's an absolute shock to the fabric of Israel.
You mean it's not Hezbollah version 2006?
Yeah, it's worse. It's more deeply committed, and Israel has really given them every reason to be so.
What's so amazing about their attitude, Larry? Recently, there is a Israeli journalist who's responsible for what's going on. He's reporting on what's going on in Lebanon and Gaza. He said, "You told us with these assassinations in Lebanon, we're gonna go and capture the land." And it would be so easy to. It doesn't seem to be that way that you were describing to us. And if a journalist who has a lot of information about the region thinks this way, what can we ma imagine about the people in Israel?
Well, I can imagine that they're finally getting to know that Netanyahu is not what they thought in terms of they hate him. I don't think there's a person in Israel who really likes Bibi, but they like what he's doing, and they like the gall and and they think the courage and the audacity with which he's doing it. They even like that he's standing up to the United States and telling them to go, blow it out your rear end, because that's the way most Jews in Israel feel. That the United States should be there and shut up, give us whatever we need and shut up. But they don't like Bibi. They do not like Bibi for all sorts of reasons across the spectrum. They don't like him. So that's one reason I'd say if you got rid of Bibi, you got plenty of people to take his place who'd be more palatable to the Jewish residents of Israel and yet would still do the same thing. But I think it's getting to the point now where the combination of recognition by the average Jewish citizen of Israel is no longer its infallible self, even with US maximum support. And Netanyahu has brought them to that point, and they're acceding to and pushing him on has brought them to that point that they're ready to get rid of him. I really do. I think they're ready to get rid of him. And I think the chain of command's ready to get rid of him too. I think he senses that. He knows that. He's going to be on the qui vive. He's going to be watchful, and he's going to surround himself with those that he thinks are, alike with him, the right wingers in particular, and tell them that if he goes, they'll probably go too. So they better hang on, and that's going to be his tactic. But I think he's doomed.
Pardon me. In Lebanon, the one of the officials in Lebanon, he's talking about that the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon is trying to talk about post-Hezbollah era in Lebanon. And do you find
Let's
any
talk about
base
the
for
post-Israeli era in Lebanon. Let's talk about Lebanon with a future. Let's talk about Lebanon not having to wait every 8 to 10 years to get bombed to smithereens. Let's talk about no Israel on their border and how peaceful that would be. That's what they need to be talking about.
And when it comes to the rhetoric on the part of the US ambassador in Lebanon, do you think that there's still a little bit of chance in their mind that they can isolate Hezbollah in Lebanon with the current situation that they're in? They're fighting in the southern part of Lebanon. They're
Yeah.
fighting
Well, we think we could, we think I was listening to our ambassador at the UN this morning. Every time I listen to her, I have the hardest time listening to her. A black woman saying the things that she says is just absolutely unforgivable in my mind. But at least today, she was saying things like, "Oh," she made this big description of this child that she met way back when who was starving to death. And how it was just unconscionable, Well, okay, yeah. What were you saying weeks ago, months ago about the situation in Gaza, and that food had to get through to these people? And she, her implication was this deal of after the election, we'll get up to 350 trucks a day or whatever. I mean, she's unconscionable, but at least she was showing that this is wearing on the empire too. And what that means, I think, for Lebanon, long way to get here, we've always pushed that element in Lebanon, generally in the minority, but able to get power, and many times because we're behind them. And that element is not Lebanon. It's a segment of Lebanese society and Lebanese politics. We get it and we try to ratchet it and run the country ourselves through that for the benefit of Israel. We've never been very successful at that. Never been very successful at it. We're not going to be successful this time. The Lebanese need to run their own country. I'm sorry, Washington. Lebanon, Beirut needs to run its own country. And the best thing for that and for the peace necessary to do that and to build it back up again is an Israel that is either a non-Jewish state, a true liberal democracy, or gone altogether. I mean, that's the reality of it. The Lebanese will never have peace until Israel is a truly liberal democratic state and therefore not a Jewish state, or gone altogether.
Do you consider the attempts on the part of Blinken to calm down the situation between Israel and Iran came to a good result in the terms of, do you think, because the way that we know that he was trying so hard, he went there, he talked with them, the Biden administration, seems to me, in my eyes, they did everything at their disposal to bring down the tensions. How did you find it? Was that a win for the Biden administration?
A temporary one, an interim one. I don't think it will last. And I say that for a number of reasons. The election coming up and the tension being created by that, what the results of that election might be, whether they are confirmed immediately or take months to confirm, and other factors like that. And how much political space has opened up so that if, for example, the Democrats win the White House and win the Senate, which is looking even more like it might happen than the White House. We have these phenomena sometimes in this country where the voters pay the White House back for what they don't think has been a very good administration, and at the same time realize that the Congress needs changing. And so you wind up flipping things that you didn't think were going to be flipped. I'm monitoring all the Senate races, for example, in that regard. And Democrats have a good chance of increasing a majority in the Senate and outside chance of increasing their numbers in the House. I don't think they're going to take the majority, but they might increase their numbers to where it'll be impossible for the Republicans to do anything without a considerable number of Democrats signing up to it. So that could change the political situation a lot. But to your question, I think this administration has been so thoroughly discredited, and Tony Blinken in particular, and individually, so thoroughly discredited, not just with the American people, but with the international community, the UN, the whole kit and caboodle, that they're going to have to do some real changing in some significant ways to recover themselves in a global sense and also in a national sense. I'm not sure they're going to be able to do the global one, really. I'm not. I think some people whom I'm talking to now who are more knowledgeable than I about international relations and the conditions in the world right now, particularly with the BRICS and such, I think this may be this may be the sealant, if you will, on our coffin. We may either be dead as an empire and take 60 years to figure it out, or we may be so long coming back that it'll be several administrations down the road before we do recover some of our international bona fides, for example. And meanwhile, consider this, while we're trying to recover our own, others are building theirs. And rather successfully, with BRICS being the quintessential example of that. Now, on top of that, add the fact that you got people like Munger out there saying we're going to crash at any moment, financially and economically. I mean, this is Berkshire Hathaway's main man. We're going to fall apart. I don't doubt it either, given the debt and all the other things that we're doing right now. We could become the most retrenched empire in the shortest period of time in human history. That is to say, we go from being everywhere in the world to being nowhere in the world and entirely back in our own territory and minding our own business and doing nothing more security-wise but saying, don't come and bother us or we'll kill you at the beaches. You know, because that's the kind of reaction that America usually presents when something this incredible happens to it. And I could see it happening. I could see us withdrawing, much the way when Trump is in his more understandable modes, much the way he talks about. We'd be home. We might still be a member of NATO, but forget it if you think we're going to come over there and do your work for you. And forget it if you think we're going to pay your burden for you. Forget it if you think we're going to do anything but provide a nuclear backdrop to your security problems. That's it. We won't be there anymore. That's a mild version of it, though. I think you're going to see a much more harsh version of it. American retrenchment is what I call
When you look at BRICS, the way that they're trying to help each other, despite having their differences, they're putting their differences aside, they're trying to help each other. Russia helping China.
all because of us. All because
Yeah,
of us.
exactly. I want to get to the point that we see this totally different manner in G7. The way that the United States destroyed Europe with this conflict, with this nonsense war in Ukraine. They destroyed Germany's economy. And we know how important Germany is within G7.
Yes.
And Japan's economy is not doing great.
And
European economy.
they just had a terrible election for the LDP. They lost any hope of ruling in the sense of a party.
And it's not just about the United States forcing the other countries to make a coalition, to make BRICS being bigger, being brighter, being more powerful. On the other hand, destroying the economy of G7. It's unbelievable when you look at the outcome. We are not talking about the little actions, the outcome of what the United States has been doing in the last at least 2 years. With the conflict in Ukraine and right now in Gaza is totally against the United States. And they're doing it that they're thinking that they're making these actions are making the United States even more powerful.
Yes, that's the thing that's the greatest mystery to me is how they can be so utterly stupid. Now, I heard something the other day. I'm having a hard time believing it. But when I think about it, I can believe it because I have been there and I've seen how personal relations can do such significant damage to the country's security posture. I heard that the real reason Biden is sticking so close to Israel, so much in Netanyahu's pocket, is he despises Barack Obama. And he wants to do as much damage as possible to Obama's reputation and to the way he treated Israel, as opposed to the way Joe is treating Israel. Now, that sounds preposterous, but I've been there and I've seen how these personal issues, personal vendettas, personal hatreds, personal passions influence significantly decision making and particularly national security decision making. And it's just a comment on our system that it can be so significant like that. But I don't want to believe it completely, but I do think I believe it has a component in this because otherwise I can't explain Biden's ignorance and stupidity. I mean, it's like he doesn't even realize what's happening in Ukraine, and he doesn't realize what's happening to America's reputation. Indeed, already in tatters from state-sponsored torture in the world because of Gaza. We are thinking like North America and those parts of Europe that are still adhering to our imperial reign is all there is in the world. I'm sorry, you know, it isn't. In fact, it's insignificant when you think about the other parts of the world and their economies. And their, what is it? BRICS, before they got the new 11 or 12 members, BRICS is combined GDP was $60.2 trillion or something like that. This is crazy, but that's the way empires get at the end.
In your opinion, right now in Gaza, it seems that Israeli's main goal right now, if they fail in the southern part of Lebanon, they want to capture, they want to occupy the northern part of Gaza.
And that's even a problem for them. I'm told they're having significant problems there, killing enough people to get the land free so that, you know, they can do what they want to do, which is colonize it. If you've seen the photographs at close range, if you've seen the satellite looks down into the actual streets and the what's left of the buildings and so forth, you have to think, even with the engineering skills of Hercules, that is going to be an incredible task just to do northern Gaza, just to clear it to the point where you can start something else, whether it's Palestinians rebuilding or whether it's Ben Gavir and his settlers out there. And what I'm being told is the IDF will go into an area that's just completely decimated and get shot at still. And so it's not, it's not peace in any way, fashion, or form. So that's really, really wearing on their morale too.
It seems that in southern part of Lebanon is the same type of scenario. They're capturing some villages, they go back and they lose.
The fighters in Lebanon, though, are skilled, trained, hardcore guerrillas. They are good, very good. The fighters in Gaza are brave, they're courageous, they fight hard, but they're not trained like the Hezbollah fighters. I mean, they've been training for years, and they're hardened, and they know that territory like the back of their hands. That's a tough enemy to take on.
I don't know if you saw the Israeli media, Channel 12, reported that three Hezbollah fighters confronted 20 soldiers, Israeli soldiers, killed and wounded, and they sent them back. These people are not the soldiers in the southern part of Lebanon, Larry, are the main soldiers of Israel, or these reservists?
They're some of the best. Yeah, they're some of the best. They're some of their best airborne, some of their best special troops, and some of their best leaders too. It's really a shock, I'm sure, to the system. Let's face it, this has been a military that was raised on its own mystique. It was the Six-Day War. It was Yom Kippur. It was everything that people were led to believe, largely by the propaganda of that very military machine. I mean, their propaganda arm should be the one that gets the Congressional Medal of Honor equivalent, not necessarily their actual forces, because their propaganda machine has just been astounding. Well, now even that is broken down. Now people are beginning to see what was the reality all along, but the Arabs seeing it, the Palestinians in particular, and Hezbollah in particular, they're seeing it, just fills them with more courage and more ability to stay the game, if you will, because they understand now this was to a certain extent a chimera. And it was a chimera that got its brilliance and its brightness because the US C-5s were just coming in all the time and giving them all this stuff and standing behind them with everything. The might of the empire was behind this little enclave at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. Now, that's not even working. That's not even enough, because you still got to have that fabric down there accepting all this material and putting it to good use, or putting it to the effective use of a military. They're not doing that anymore because they've got real opposition now. Moshe Dayan's old aphorism or statement about it helps to be fighting Arabs no longer is relevant. That's probably the biggest change in this whole setting. And imagine if the other Arabs were to suddenly jump in. What would the United States do? I've been asking myself that question. What would we do? What would this current bunch of insane idiots in Washington do? And what would a sane U.S. government, reasonably sane government, like the one, like H.W. Bush, Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker, what would they have done if this circumstance suddenly presented it to them? That is to say, all their Arab allies, by and large, from Jordan to Riyadh to Qatar, everywhere, suddenly decided it was time to end Israel. Whose side would we take? Well, the obvious answer for HW and Brent and Jim and Colin would have been, we'll jump into the middle of it and try to mediate. We'll try to use diplomacy. We'll promise here, promise there, promise, try to mediate and try to get it stopped before it gets out of hand and you know, we have a Holocaust. I don't know what this bunch of idiots would do in Washington. Probably sit there with their thumb in their mouth and try to figure out what to do. They just don't have the bona fides. They don't have the credibility. They don't have the brains to deal with this kind of situation. But, you know, wars have a tendency of doing this sort of thing, as Clausewitz was so apt to point out. Suddenly you wake up the next morning and everything's changed. The whole tapestry has changed. All of your conception of the region has changed. All of your deployments are meaningless because you're not deployed for the new situation. What do you do? How do you adapt? How do you move into whatever your next phase is? A deeper and more deadly prosecution of the conflict, or some attempt to use diplomacy and good offices to stop it before it gets out of hand completely and maybe turns nuclear, which is my big worry. The Solomon option is always there for Bibi. You know, pull the temple down, pull the temple down. And don't care about all the people you pull the temple down on. I don't see Washington having the capabilities to handle this kind of situation. So it worries me. It worries me greatly.
In your opinion, does the Netanyahu administration concern about what's happening right now in the eyes of Arab states in terms of the conflict between Israel and Iran, in terms of what's going on in the southern part of Lebanon? It seems that the picture of Israel is changing in their eyes.
Dramatically. Dramatically changing. This morning I heard from one individual, and I just heard from Amman, that the King of Jordan was apoplectic about Israel violating its airspace. Then this morning I heard that the King of Jordan gave permission for Israel to violate its airspace, to use its airspace. I don't know what the truth is. But I can't imagine, even if the king had given his permission, I can't imagine him being public about it because he's sitting on a powder keg. He is sitting on an absolute powder keg, as to a certain extent is General Sisi in Egypt sitting on a powder keg. And it could go off at any moment. And then, like we just said, you've got chaos and all over the place. And what would the great empire do if all of its allies suddenly became non-allies, and all because of that little enclave at the eastern end of the Mediterranean called Israel. And more than that, that butcher called Netanyahu. But it could happen. It could happen, and all of a sudden we'd be confronted with quite a different situation, and almost overnight. I'm sure we're beavering away trying to keep that from happening. We must be holding at least three or four hands in the GCC right now, trying to keep everybody on an even keel.
I think what has happened in Africa is so alarming for the United States because it can come to the Middle East soon. And Nobody seems to care about that, Larry.
It's Ukraine and Gaza have this incredible capability, as is the case almost all the time with the U.S. leadership, to suck all the oxygen out of the air. And it's like you've got blinders on and you can't see the things that are happening around you that are probably far more dangerous to your future than what you're looking at in the scope but you don't realize it.
We had Bill Burns together with the head of Mossad in Qatar talking about the situation in Gaza. It seems that there were no representatives from Hamas in these talks. Qataris were talking together with the heads of CIA and Mossad. Do you understand what does Bill Burns want to achieve? In your opinion, is he trying to make some sort of, I don't know, common ground? Because here comes the, we have 2024 presidential election. We are approaching. So, and what is he trying to do right now, in your opinion?
You've got the old stereotype that's totally destroyed. The old stereotype was you went in, if you were Bill Burns in this circumstance, and you scared everybody with the Soviet Union. And you got them to understand that in order to be protected from the Soviet Union, they had to more or less do your will. They had to toe the line. They had to come along with your policy needs. What do you do now? You go in and you say, bugaboo China, bugaboo Russia. Well, Russia has done nothing but come in and appear to be the good guy on the block. China has done nothing but kind of back that up. China, Xi's been offering his good offices to settle the whole thing, to conduct diplomacy, get everybody up. Same thing with Ukraine. Get everybody to Geneva or some other neutral ground, and we'll officiate over all this. And we'll make sure that there's diplomacy that's successful. Implication there, of course, is that Washington can't do that. Washington either won't do that or can't do that or both. So what does Bill do? What does he use to scare these people? Does he tell them that the U.S. is the greatest producer of crude oil in the world now, so they don't have to worry about the Strait of Hormuz and Saudi Arabia and Russia? That doesn't work, because it doesn't matter if we do 22 million barrels a day, because the rest of the world has got plenty of oil too. I don't know what kind of leverage Bill uses. He can't use financial leverage, not really, or sanctions leverage, because we're going tits up, Nima, in terms of our financial situation. I don't know how he does it. He's got to use a lot of skill in creating something that is a influencer with the people in the region who count, the people on the ground who count. And I know his main purpose, probably, his main objective is to squelch any idea of a war between Iran and Israel, Israel and Iran, and thus the United States. That's his main diplomatic purpose, is to ensure that that doesn't evolve out of this situation where the United States is so encumbered in the Middle East that it winds up being its 1956 Suez Canal crisis for Britain. We're mired there and can't get out. I don't know how you do that, though. I wish him luck. I don't know how you do that. There's nothing you can scare them with. They're not scared anymore.
Larry, recently Donald Trump, you know that the 2024 presidential election is coming, and one of the candidates that has a chance to win in 2024 is Donald Trump. That's why he's important. What he's saying right now is important. On one side, we're hearing that he's talking about, we are not interested in having a conflict in the Middle East, a war with Iran in the Middle East. Even with Russia, he wants to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine. His pick for the vice president, J.D. Vance, recently in an interview said that it doesn't matter if Israel wants a war with Russia, with Iran. We are not interested in that. You see, on one hand, they're talking this way. On the other hand, it seems that Trump is talking about maybe Mike Pompeo going to be in the next administration, Nikki Haley, in Tom Cotton, and these people. How do you put these pictures together? Do you think, if, let's assume Trump wins, is he going to change? Is he going to learn from his first administration? Is he going to do some sort of changes in his administration in 2024? Or it's all talk? it's all about election right now. In the aftermath of the election, everything gonna change, and deep state gonna dominate.
If past is prologue in any way, I think we're going to see more of the same that we saw in the first 4 years. We're going to see a lot of people coming and going because they're going to, as you just intimated, they're going to contravene what Trump really wants to do if he feels like he wants to do it badly enough. You know, we saw national security advisors come and go. The only person that hung around for quite a while was Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. It will be important whom he selects for that position, because that position, probably of all the cabinet level positions, will be the only one that adheres for a while. You just don't want to be disturbing that person too often, because he did towards the end. But that's the place that everything centers around in an empire like the United States now, which is why I used to tell Colin Powell, why the hell did you want to be Secretary of State? Why do you want to be Secretary of Defense? You get billions of dollars there and you get tens of dollars over here. So that's the only place I think would probably be fairly stable. Otherwise, I think he'll clean house every time someone speaks up and disagrees with him. And he'll put J.D. Vance in a closet if he disagrees with him. Here's a disturbing note. When I was in New York, I heard some chatter about, and it makes sense to me, Trump's longevity. And Peter Thiel and others who are really who made J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance is just Peter Thiel's creation. They're counting on Trump not making it for 4 years. And I don't mean assassination or anything like that. They just, you know, he's almost as old as Joe Biden. That he's going to probably vacate the office because he's going to die and JD is going to take over, and then they're going to take over. Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, all these people. I don't like to believe those kinds of things about my country, but it has a resonating note to it that's what these Miriam Adelsons and Peter Thiels and Roger, what's the guy named Mercer, these other billionaires that are backing Trump to the hill, they're not stupid people. And they know what Trump is. And they know the only reason they're backing him is because he's got his hands around the Republican Party. And that's one of the parties that can win all the power. What they're going to do with that power, if he wins it the second time, is anybody's guess. I don't think it's going to be good for America. But what you've said is, some of the things he's saying, I think Trump himself is saying, in order to appeal to the electorate that is disenchanted with Ukraine, disenchanted with Gaza and all the rest. And he looks different. He looks very different. He looks starkly different in that regard. Now, throw the other little piece of information out there that David Rothkopf just wrote about, where he thinks that the polling system in the United States, for example, has become entirely the subject of and beholden to various parts of the political spectrum. And so you never get good polls. You never get good polls. You have to go look somewhere way down in the deep, dank darkness to find some pollster who's not bought and paid for. And so what we're seeing with this razor thin business, you know, 42, 43, 44, 43, that's right. Oh, she's up now to 44 and he's down to 43. You know, what we're seeing is them playing with the polls and trying to keep both sides interested. And therefore the media having lots of things to talk about and lots of scare stories to tell. David thinks the Democrats are going to win by a wide margin. And I don't know that David's wrong, because he's absolutely right about how corrupt the media and the polling and everything else is. And I'm listening to the National Task Force on Election Crises, who I've been involved with two elections now, this third one. I'm not a member of it anymore, but I still take their briefings and get their briefings. And I'm seeing that it's looking like there's been some violence. A little bit in Arizona, as I understand. They burned some ballot boxes in Oregon and Washington State, a few other things like that. And they expect there will be some intimidation of voters in voting lines and such by Trump MAGA people or whatever. But I think we're going to have a pretty free and fair election. And if we do, I think Kamala's going to win. And maybe by a substantial margin. I'm pretty positive she's going to win the popular vote, even with all the discontent in the Arab majority states, for example, not majority, but lots of Arabs in what, Wisconsin, Michigan, and so forth. So that could throw everything in a cocked hat, too. What do we do if we have more of the same? That is really, I can look at Trump and I can say, as long as I don't wind up in jail, I could live with him. I can't look at Harris and think if she's going to be another Biden, I could live with that. I might come down to São Paulo and drop down.
That's going to be a tragedy.
There's a lot riding on this, a lot riding on this election, and a lot riding on the outcome in terms of not just getting to the inauguration peacefully and having a new president, but also in terms of policies. And what's going to happen in that period of sort of more or less stasis, where, what is Biden going to be doing? If Biden is really motivated by his dislike of, hatred was the word used with me, of Barack Obama, what does that mean for the rest of his term? I mean, what's going to happen with respect to these two critical theaters of war, for example? What's going to happen with respect to the economy? The FDIC, Nima, is in debt, $75 to $100 billion. This is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that every American with bank accounts depends on to protect its bank accounts if the bank collapses. It shouldn't be in debt. Its budget is the insurance premiums the banks pay. Well, that means they haven't been paying their premiums. That means the banks are in real trouble. We could have a real catastrophe between now and inauguration, or right after inauguration, that we aren't even expecting, that the American people haven't a clue is coming down the road. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I know the answer is not more of the same.
Before wrapping up, Larry, I want to play a clip of General Petraeus. He's talking about Gaza, the situation in Gaza, and his
I have
point.
to watch David Petraeus.
Vision for the future of the Palestinian people that is similar to the vision that we presented to the people of Iraq before we conducted the major operations that we did there during the surge. And we would go to the people of Fallujah and we would tell them in advance of our operation, we are going to make your lives better. We're going to do it by getting Al-Qaeda out of your neighborhoods. And then we're going to stay in those neighborhoods. We're going to create gated communities, essentially. This is an accurate description, but with much more effective walls. In fact, we would tell them, I said, look, it costs a lot of money to be in a gated community in Florida, and we're going to give it to you for free here in Fallujah. Yeah. What a disconnected man. Absolutely disconnected. Reminds me of 2004 when my spy was in Baghdad and was reporting to me when Petraeus was telling the president of the United States that the Iraqi battalions were being trained up, that they were ready to go, that right now they could defend Iraq's territory, and soon they would be able to spin off and maybe help policing for the Ministry of the Interior and so forth. And my friend was telling me the AWOL rate was something like 30% every morning, that they couldn't hit with a pistol or a rifle a target 30 feet away. I mean, this is David Petraeus. This is the guy. The surge in Iraq, the surge worked because the Sunnis decided that it was better to be absent from Al-Qaeda's ranks and present in the U.S. ranks until the U.S. got its ass out of Iraq. And they decided also that they would prepare for the future and be ready to slaughter the Shia whenever they needed to slaughter them, because the Shia had begun to put them in the jail and kill them and so forth. So they just wanted to get us out. They just wanted to get us gone. So they went along with the surge. And Petraeus knew that, I think. I think he knew that. He took advantage of that. And then my question to David would be, been to Iraq lately? Been to Iraq lately? we ruined Iraq. We destroyed Iraq. And it'll be another 15 or 20 years before it even crawls out from under the rubble we left it in. And if you walk down the street of Baghdad and ask any Iraqi in the bazaars or wherever, were you better off under Saddam or now? They'll say Saddam. So why would anyone even listen to that man?
The same.
I'll tell you one, because we're mesmerized by these guys with the stars and all the cauliflower, you know, and all this stuff. I was one of them. I wasn't quite as high ranking as he, but we mesmerize Americans, you know. But we're stupid, by and large, especially when we put 4 stars on, 3 stars on. We're stupid.
Yeah, I've met a Libyan doctor here in Brazil. He said that in those days of Gaddafi in Libya, they thought that by the removal of Gaddafi in Libya, that everything going to be solved, but it's just worsened.
Yeah.
We talked about what has happened to Libya.
We set that all up. I mean, we had fairly good relations with Gaddafi after he decided. We took down the AQCON network. He was a part of that network, but he had the good sense to get out of it at the last minute. We had a deal with him. If he took care of Libya and the oil kept flowing, light sweet crude, and maybe he'd back off his gold plan and all that other stuff that he was talking about, everything could be good. We knew Libya was fairly well run. We knew that Libyans had a pretty decent situation, almost like Iraq before the first Gulf War. Best country in the Middle East outside Israel in terms of treating women, universities, women could teach, all that sort of stuff. So we then went in and bombed the Nakatutu out of it, you know. And we did Libya. That was the most stunning thing to me, having come out of the administration where we were making deals and having lunch with Gaddafi in Tripoli. And all of a sudden, here we are leading a NATO gang into Libya and taking out the only guy who could control the country. Mistake? Huge mistake. And President Obama even admitted it.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
We went all over the map, didn't we?
Exactly.
Well, let's hope things turn out for the best.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry.
Take care.
Take care.